Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time, Monday, the 31st of May, 2010. And I want to thank everybody for tuning in, and your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona. Now, the website is hourofthetime.com. My personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. The studio number, 928-333-2942. And I want to get right into the content for this evening. Many of you may not have ever heard of Dr. John Coleman, our special guest at the conference this year. So I want to give you an audio selection from him this evening to listen to. It's a very good piece. You're only getting a portion of it from a seminar I attended called The Committee of 300. Now, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget that the Hour of the Time is listener-supported. And through your support is how we maintain our presence on the airwaves and how we expand and do new endeavors all the time.
The message that I hope will galvanize us all into much needed action. The problem is quite simple. Anarchy and chaos prevails in Washington, D.C., because the federal government has seized powers to which it is not entitled to and is passing masses of laws that are 100% unconstitutional. And when you get men setting themselves up as greater than the Constitution of the United States, you get anarchy and eventually tyranny. Now, I'm paranoid. I'm going to admit to you right up front. But let me tell you what the real meaning of the word paranoid is. It is a man or a person who has the ability to link events that seemingly are not connected. That is the true meaning of paranoia, or being paranoid. Of course, it's been used by our enemies, the socialists, the Marxists, the liberals, the so-called progressives, to smear us. How many times haven't I heard it said of me, that fellow's paranoid? Yes, I'm glad to admit it, because I have the ability to connect events that are seemingly unconnected. And when you do that, you begin to arrive at the truth. It's taken me 25 years to come to the conclusion that I have come to. And I want to tell you that one of the biggest things I discovered in my work was the existence of a supranational committee composed of 300 men. I came across this quite by accident when I was serving in Africa, in Angola, and I was given a series of documents which were only supposed to be handed in to top-level people. They were what we called above the top level of classification of intelligence documents. And there I discovered that whilst I thought I was in Africa fighting against the invasion of the communists, I was in fact fighting to introduce socialist regimes in the black African countries, and that I was actually working for a committee called the Committee of 300, also known in intelligence circles as the Olympian. I'll stop right there, and I want to digress for a moment and tell you the word intelligence. It's been bandied around a great deal in the United States. I've seen people writing this and that and the other intelligence newsletter. and really have no experience whatsoever, 1986, I said that the top-level intelligence organization in the United States was the National Reconnaissance Office, far bigger than the CIA and any of the other intelligence agencies. And by the way, we have about 10 different ones in the United States. And I even had the audacity to give the address of this organization. 3 weeks ago, Mr. Sam Donaldson, the gentleman who wears that beautiful toupee so effectively, he came on with the program in prime time and he said, this is one of the biggest scoops that ABC has ever had. And he told about the National Reconnaissance Organization. The exact same thing that I published 8 years earlier. I tell you this to set the stage so that you'll understand I do have some experience and that I know that of which I speak. You know, the American people are somewhat like the Irish. I'm sure you've heard the story of the Irishman who got shipwrecked, and after many days he was washed up on an island, and as he staggered along the beach, some people came out of the trees waving spears, and he said to them, is there a government here? And they said, yes. He said, well then I'm against it. Liberty is based on individual freedom. We are individual people. We are not the mass, so disdainfully referred to by Karl Marx and the socialist writers. We objected to a tax of a penny a pound on tea when King George of the Venetian Party of the North, now that's probably the first time you've heard that expression. It took me 5 years of digging in the British Museum of London, which I consider to be the finest repository of knowledge in the world, to come up with that name. That was what the party of King George was called, and we'll come to the reason for that. But our colonists said, we're not going to pay this penny a pound on tea. Today, we are being driven on our knees by a tyrannical government, which is imposing all sorts of taxes upon us, and worse than that, trampling on and tramping on the Constitution of the United States of America, which is the second greatest document in the world next to the Bible. And if we could rebel against the mighty powers of King George III, the most potent force in the world at that time, then, ladies and gentlemen, then it is time that we rebelled against a federal government that is trampling the Constitution underfoot every day of the week. King George III of the Venetian Party of the North did more than that. He sent Adam Smith, a servant of the British East India Company, to formulate a policy which he called free trade. And by the means of free trade, Adam Smith, a greatly beloved economist of the Marxists, the socialists, and the liberals, hoped to bring the small manufactories and the industries established by the colonists to their knees. Let me tell you unequivocally that free trade is piracy. There is no such thing as free trade. We have to reject this constant brainwashing to which we are subjected. Free trade began with Adam Smith and the British East India Company. Now, who is the British East India Company? They played a massive role in the history of the United States of America. Only you are not taught this in your schools or in your universities, but you need to know. In my book, The Committee of 300, which took 20 years of research, and incidentally, I was only a little bit behind with Karl Marx. He spent 30 years in the British Museum in London, where he got most of his things from. I point out that the British East India Company was the most powerful trading company in the world. They made their massive monies out of the dope trade. They first grew prime poppies in Kew Gardens in Kensington, London, got the best producing opium poppies. They then shipped them to Benares in India, where they began a massive plantation of poppies, opium producing poppies. They then used their famous sea clippers to transport the poppies in the form of raw opium to China. And by their military force, they imposed an opium policy on China that turned the Chinese nation into a nation of addicts. And they enforced this policy, which was known to the royal family and Lord Gladstone, the Prime Minister, and every one of the lords and ladies in England. And they made a massive, huge fortune in researching these documents in India House in London. I came across some of the manifests of the old tea clippers and the numbers of kegs of opium they carried in the values. And I totaled up these things, and I found to my astonishment that if we took 1970 as an optimum year for profits in General Motors and Ford, in 1 year, the opium trade with China was 3 times the profits of the combined profits of Ford and General Motors in 1970. And this was shared by 300 people. That was the committee that ran the British East India Company. They all had equal voting rights. They could not outvote each other, and of course they were sworn to secrecy. The descendants of the British East India Company today run the United States. And I will hope to prove my thesis as we go along. They also interfered in the development of the United States on every occasion. They armed the Indians, they armed the people against the settlers who were pushing west. They ran the Hudson's Bay Company. They also ran so-called mission stations in China and got these missionaries, who were really not missionaries at all, to push opium on the Chinese. And I remember a conversation with the late Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, Prime Minister of Egypt, President of Egypt, and Mohammed Eichel, one of the top journalists, with Chou Enlai. And Chou Enlai told him, he said, you know, the Americans and the British made China a nation of opium addicts, and now with the Vietnam War, it's our turn. We are going to make the Americans a nation of opium addicts. So you can see the influence, the evil, baleful influence of the British East India Company upon the great nation of the United States of America. They were the ones who financed the war. They put up the money for the British troops to buy the Hessian mercenaries and to fight the colonists. Those brave 3%, let me remind you that only 3% of the people took arms and stood up against the mighty army of King George III. We are 3% here this morning, but that's enough for us to withstand the mighty force of the federal government of the United States of America. These 300 men in the Committee of 300 still run the world today with an iron fist. Their wealth is untold, cannot be measured. I know I looked at some of the records that I could find in Italy, in Rome. I've done most of my work on location, and this has always been invaluable to me. And I came across the families in Italy who were called the Fondi, meaning the people who had all the money. They were all members of the Committee of 300, the Lucatis, the Recanatis, the Volpi du Miseratis. These people are so wealthy that they would make David Rockefeller look like a piker. That is how rich they are. And this is the committee that runs the world. Now, in my book, The Committee of 300, I name every one of them. This is not a book that talks about they. It gives you specifics. And I must say, I do the same thing in my new book, Socialism, The Road to Slavery, which was 10 years in researching. On July the 4th, 1789, George Washington told the Congress, it is necessary for us to impose tariffs to protect the manufactories of our colonies. That was the first trade barrier. Now, let us dispose for once and for all with the words that have been implanted on our minds, like isolationist, and you are for restricted trade, and you are against global trade. The United States of America did not grow great on global trade. The United States of America grew great on the hard labor of the people who lived in those days and the wise protection barriers put up by President George Washington, because immediately after the war, they tried, the British, to try to down the United States through so-called free trade, which is nothing but piracy. Free trade, ladies and gentlemen, is a one-way street which allows other countries to dump their products on our markets to the detriment of our own people. That's what free trade is. It's strictly a one-way street. The trade barriers were increased by Lincoln, Garfield, and McKinley. And all three presidents paid with their lives for that policy. Disraeli was particularly incensed with Lincoln. Disraeli was the British Prime Minister at the time. And he ordered British MI6 to assassinate Lincoln, which is what they did. The same way as British MI6 publicly executed President John F. Kennedy at a later time. Our founding fathers and our presidents saw the value of trade barriers. They realized that we, if we wanted to progress, were not to be the dumping ground of the world. And I'm going to leave that subject for now and return to it later. The format that I want to use this morning is the type of questions that are most often asked of me. I've spoken to hundreds of thousands of people across the United States and worldwide. And I've been on many, many radio shows. And these types of questions, we note them. And this is what comes up most of all. Who and what is the Committee of 300? Well, I've dealt with that. I've told you this is a supranational body that knows no boundaries, respects the laws of no countries. The first time that they were publicly announced was by a German socialist by the name of Walter Rathenau. Now, I'll give you some background of Walter Rathenau. He was the financial advisor to the Kaiser of Germany, and he was also the financial advisor to the Rothschilds, the French family Rothschild. So he must have known what he's talking about. He made an astonishing statement in 1934. He said, there is a committee of 300 men that rule the world. They are known only to each other, and nothing happens without their consent. When former head of state Mikhail Gorbachev visited the United States a few years ago, flanked by George Bush and Quayle, he opened his Gorbachev Foundation in the United States. And he left it. He said, this has been done with approval of the Committee of 300. CNN cameras were on him. They immediately switched. Now, I wrote to CNN, and I said, could I have a transcript of this program, which they said was available. I never got a reply. I followed it up with letter after letter, but nothing ever came of it. The point I'm trying to make, ladies and gentlemen, is that the federal government, the secret upper-level parallel government that runs the United States, does not want you to know that you have an upper-level parallel government that calls the shots, that dictates what is going to happen to your life and mine. So that's how I found out about the Committee of 300. The next question is, what are their goals? Their goals are a one-world government, latterly called the New World Order. The one-world government began with King George III. At the time that the colonists were brave enough to take him on, King George was already busy formulating a one-world government, and he had lined up at least 50 countries that were willing to come into this future world dictatorship with him. The goals, then, very simply stated, are to make the world over into a one-world, new world order dictatorship controlled utterly and completely by this Committee of 300. How can they possibly carry out their goals? That's the next question that I'm often asked. They do it by dint and by virtue of their fantastic wealth and the fact that they control thousands of the top banking institutions, the political organizations, insurance companies. In fact, one of the giant insurance companies, a man called me and said, do you mean to tell me that they are controlling the Metropolitan of New York? I said, the Metropolitan of New York is peanuts. He said, how can you say that? That's a giant American company. I said, well, compared with the Assicurazioni Generali di Venezia, it's peanuts. That's the biggest insurance company in the world. They control in that organization. Everything that happens in the world in the insurance field comes out of Venice. That's why Venice is so important, because in Venice we have the black nobility. Now that has nothing to do with the color of the skin of the people, and I'm going to come back to them as we go along. So the goals are a one world dictatorship of the most brutal kind. And how they carry it out is they have these interface banks, insurance companies, mining conglomerates, every conceivable control in politics, including the Democrat Party of the United States, which is, of course, since 1980 behind closed doors at the secret caucus in Washington, D.C. The Democrat hierarchy took on the goals of the old Socialist Party USA, i.e. based upon the Communist Manifesto of 1848. If you have a copy of my book, and I'm not pushing it, but in my book, The Committee of 300, I list every one of their huge, gigantic corporations, how they interface. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is an eye-opener, because it gets right down to the nitty-gritty of your everyday life in the cities and towns across the United States. So they carry out their goals through existing organizations. And also, of course, they have built up some special organizations of their own. When I first started writing in America, when I came there in 1969, I revealed the existence of an organization called the Royal Institute for International Affairs, which is located at Chef Chatham House in Thames and James Square in London. I also revealed the existence of the Club of Rome, the Cini Foundation, the Montelleran Society, the Order of St. John, which is known but not known. And I listed all of these secret societies that run the world as executive arms of the Committee of 300. So it controls the world through all of these. The Royal Institute for International Affairs is the executive arm of this committee, which gives instructions to the United States government to this very day. The chain of command is as follows. Every Secretary of State that has been appointed since 1919 is appointed by the Royal Institute for International Affairs. That may come as a shock for you. You think you vote and you put a conservative in the White House, and then he appoints supposedly or allegedly conservative people to carry out the policies that you wanted him to implement. Surprise, surprise. I ask you to find me a conservative Secretary of State since 1919. And if you search diligently and apply the correct rules, you will come out blank. Every one of the Secretaries of State was chosen in London by the Secretary of State, as was Wilson, the President Wilson, as was Roosevelt, as was James Earl Carter. He was specially chosen because he had three mental breakdowns, and they felt he would be a good guy to manipulate. Oh, I'm talking facts. I'll tell you the story of that. In my World in Review news magazine, I wrote that, James, I'm digressing a bit here, but it's necessary to do that now and then. It's not a sign of a bad speaker, although I don't put any laurels around my own neck. But James Earl Carter is not a known entity in the American scene. I first heard of him through my intelligence contacts, particularly my French sources, who are one of the best in the world after MI6. And he told me, your next president is going to be a peanut farmer from Georgia. And I said, how come? He said, right now they're meeting at the Dorchester Hotel in London. And if you get your fanny over there, he said, you'll find that there's a lot of goings on you might like to look at. And lo and behold, that's what was happening. The Royal Institute for International Affairs had ordered David Rockefeller to find a candidate who was totally weak, preferably a little mentally weak. And they put one of the greatest brainwashing specialists in the world, trained by the Tavistock Institute for Human Relations, Dr. Peter Bourne, on the job. And he said, it's funny you should say that. One of my patients is a guy from Georgia, James Earl Carter. And this guy can't take rejection, and he's been to me three times for a nervous breakdown. So they hiked Carter over to London and fated him at the Dorchester Hotel, which is a very ritzy place. And they fated him and wined and dined him. And the next thing we saw, Time, Newsweek, every newspaper in the country, James Earl Carter. Now we, in our little magazine, World in Review, we told those of our subscribers, this man is your next president. We also did exactly the same thing with William Jefferson Clinton, because we had the story of the Club of Rome. We knew who Agnelli was. We knew that Agnelli had had a huge love affair with Mrs. Pamela Harriman, and that Mrs. Pamela Harriman was the doyen of the Democrat Party, and Mrs. Harriman had been given a task of finding the next president of the United States, a socialist. And she picked up Clinton and said, "You're our boy." But there's one snag. Now, Clinton went up there, brushing his forelock back, said, "Well, you know, there's one problem. My wife left me." And Mrs. Harriman was dumbfounded. She said, "Well, you better give it back in a hurry." He said, "No, she doesn't want to come back to me because of my fights with other women." That's how he put it. My philandering would have been a better word, but he said fights with other women. So Mrs. Harriman sent for Mrs. Clinton, and she duly came to New York, and she sat her down and said, "Look, if you want to be the first lady of America, with all the attendant prestige and power, you better forget about your husband's philandering and get right back to him." And that is precisely what happened. And when I heard that had happened, I knew this guy was the next president. And we wrote that in our news magazine. And sure enough, a year later, here came marching into the scene William Jefferson Clinton. So the RIA, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, does control everything that happens in the United States. They give their orders to the Morgan Guarantee and Trust Bank on Wall Street. And the chief executive officer of that organization is Dennis Weatherstone. And he duly relays the orders over to the Secretary of State, whoever that happens to be. And he then relays the orders to the President. There was one exception to this, and that was during the illegal 100% unconstitutional Gulf War. Now, I'm going to use a word, and I apologize to the ladies for this, but I need to tell you this graphically to illustrate the power that the Royal Institute for International Affairs exercises over the affairs of the United States of America. When George Bush was hesitating and didn't know whether he should get into the Gulf or not, the Prime Minister of Britain, Mrs. Margaret Thatcher, came over to the Committee of Heads of 300 headquarters at the Aspen Institute, Colorado. And this is the phone call that she had with George Bush. She said, "George, this is Margaret. Apologies to you, Lady President. Get your ass up here. I've got some orders for you about the Gulf War." And Bush went scurrying up there like a little messenger boy. And the next thing we know, there was this massive outpouring of propaganda to start a war against the nation of Iran, a nation that has never done this country one iota of harm. I use those illustrations in order to give you the extent of the control that is exercised by this Committee of 300. There are many other societies that are operating for the RIIA. The Illuminati, which has been around for many, many years. I've written a work called The Illuminati in America, 1784 to 1994. A lot of people think this is an ancient secret society that's gone away. They think that Adam Weishaupt had a quarrel with the Catholic Church and that's it. Don't you believe it? 13 of the top families in the United States are in the Illuminati today, and they have a big say on everything that happens politically in this country. Then we have the Society of Cincinnati, which I don't think many of you will have heard about. That is an ultra, ultra secret society to which every president of the United States is forced to belong, including our so-called conservative president. And I point this out to you to show you that it doesn't matter who is in the White House. This committee of 300, through the Royal Institute for International Affairs, through the Council on Foreign Relations, exercises complete control. But their strongest arm is called the Club of Rome. Now, when I first heard of the Club of Rome in 1969, I immediately began my investigation. And as Ken told you, all of my investigations have been done on location. Every one of them. The Club of Rome is one of the most insidious, baneful organizations in existence today, which has done intolerable, immeasurable harm to the United States of America. This Committee of 300 told a man called Aurelio Pecci to form the Club of Rome with the main object of bringing down the industry and the agricultural development of the United States.
he immediately wrote a paper in which he said there are too many people on the earth, and that the United States, with its industrial development, its agricultural development, is responsible for this curse of overpopulation. And he picked up the documentation for his work from Lord Buzz Bertrand Russell, a senior statesman of the Committee of 300. And Lord Bertrand Russell had written a work called The Impact of Science on Society. And if you can ever secure a copy of that book, which I doubt you'll be able to get, you will see in there that he said, the world is grossly overpopulated and we have to get rid of at least half of the world's population, and it doesn't matter how we do it. So the Club of Rome was instituted and organized to start an attack on the world's population using the United States as the whipping boy. And they came up with a paper called The Zero Growth Post-Industrial Plan for Industry and Agriculture for the United States of America. 3 days after that plan was accepted as official United States policy by James Earl Carter, I was able to, through my intelligence people, get a copy of this insidious document. Basically what it said was that the middle class in the United States of America had to be destroyed, because in the coming push to a world order, the middle class would be the stumbling block, because history had shown that the peasant class in ancient days, when they had revolted, were just easily crushed. There was no resistance. But now had grown a new super class of people in the United States called the middle class, who had long-term employment, who had job security, who were well paid, who could afford to buy the products that were made by the United States and didn't need to buy products from China or anywhere else. And the Club of Rome post-industrial zero growth paper said, this has got to stop. We have to bring down the middle class of the United States. And the way that we will do this, the way that we will accomplish this task, is by crushing their industries. In 1980, based on this report, I wrote a small work, a booklet, called The Death of the United States Steel Industry. In that, I told of a French aristocrat by the name of Étienne Darignon, and I'm sure there's not a single steel worker in America out of a job who's ever heard of this man's name. But they put this aristocrat onto the job of destroying first the steel industry. In my book in 1980, I said that by 1985 we would have silent blast furnaces. The rolling mills would be stopped. There'd be no more shipbuilding. We'd have thousands of skilled workers who'd pass the skills of their trade down for generations, who were forever dispossessed of their jobs. If you go to the Northeast United States today, ladies and gentlemen, and I've just been up in Cleveland where I had a very good radio address I gave there, you will find that what I said in 1980 unhappily comes to pass. In 1970, the United States had 5,000 ships built by good United States know-how, using good United States steel. 5,000 ships sailing the high seas. Last year, we had exactly 270 such ships. And at least 50,000 steel workers permanently out of a job, jobs that will never come back. What happened? Did we suddenly lose our marvel? Did we suddenly lose that great American know-how of getting things done? Did we lack finances? Did we run out of money? No. None of those things happened. What happened was this dastardly Club of Rome had sent their emissaries to the United States to deliberately destroy our steel plants. And they did it by opening the doors of so-called free trade. And everybody who signed the NAFTA Treaty and everybody who signs the GATT Treaty when it passes is a traitor and a seditionist. Our mighty steel industry is destroyed. Our ships yards of silence. Our skilled workers are permanently without a job. And if you don't believe me, get the report of the Club of Rome. You know, when I came out in 1969 with my report on the Club of Rome, nobody had ever heard of it. And people, when they got it, said, "Now, this guy's paranoid. There's no such organization. It's probably something to do with the Catholic Church." Well, surprise, surprise, 25 years later, last year, the Club of Rome celebrated its anniversary, and Alexander King, its chairman, stated, "The American people henceforth must get used to the idea that they will never, ever again in their lifetime have full employment." What a scandalous thing that our government is fully cooperating with global genocide. That brings me to the next question. What is the Global 2000? Once again, when I heard about this policy, it was 3 days after it had been accepted by the United States government as its official policy. And the Global 2000 was a blueprint for mass genocide produced by the Club of Rome. Basically, what the Global 2000 calls for is the destruction of half of the world's population by the year 2050, hence the title 2000. They built a case based on Bertrand Russell and H.G. Wells' findings that the world was going to be overpopulated, would be a terrible place to live in. That was picked up by a fellow called Robert Strange McNamara, and a stranger individual you're not likely to meet in this world. And this fellow had a conference of all the leading bankers about 12 years ago, and he said the biggest menace facing the world today is the American middle class and overpopulation. He linked the two together. And he said, by the year 2050, this is the state of the world. All of these unfed, unwashed people. No jobs. He said, do we want to live in a world like that? So the Global 2000 was a genocidal plan to take care of the people of the United States who don't have any jobs and who, like Alexander King said, are never going to get their jobs back, and the masses of people in other nations. That is why we have the sudden appearance of AIDS. Eyes in the service, or so, there's a CAB experiment, that's chemical and bacteriological warfare experiment, going on in Sierra Leone, in Africa. That's a remote corner of Africa, West Africa, just above Liberia. If you look at your map and your atlas, and you'll see where it's located. Why Liberia? Extremely hard country to get to. You have to fly from London. That's the only way you can get there. You land on an island, and then you've got to take a ferry across to the mainland. And of course, all people taking the ferry are heavily scrutinized. And I managed to work my way. I was told the Americans were doing the CAB experiment. I managed to work my way to within striking distance of a small mission station. And what I discovered was that these blacks were coming in from the bush to this mission station with broken arms or an ulcer on the leg or something like that. And they were ostensibly being treated there, but they were dead by the evening. What was actually going on was that a laboratory had been set up using Lassa fever virus. Now, at that time, Lassa fever was one of four viruses that could jump the human-animal barrier. And it was a deadly virus. They were trying to create a virus that could be mass-produced and that could be sent out through the World Health Organization to get rid of millions of people in the world. But the Lassa fever virus proved uncontrollable. It killed three scientists who were working there. So the orders came from Washington, burn the place to the ground, and that's exactly what they did, within a radius of 100 miles. They bottled up some of these viruses they'd been experimenting with and took them back to the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. There they began again, but again they escaped and killed three more scientists. So they incinerated the whole laboratory, shivered off and incinerated. The same experiments are now going on in Harvard University right now. But they're not using the Lassa fever virus. That has proved to be too tough for them to handle. Instead, the United States government gave millions of dollars to the United States military chemical and bacteriological warfare establishment at Port Jeffrey. They began experimenting with the AIDS virus. I knew about the AIDS 3 years before the word ever came out in the world, in the United States particularly, because of my field work in Sierra Leone. The British government used their Portendown CAB facility it's easier to get into the Bank of England vaults than to get into Porton Down. All the deadliest viruses in the world are being crafted there. In pursuance of the goal of the Global 2000 to decimate the world, shortly after this experiment was finished at Fort Detrick, the World Health Organization started a massive vaccination campaign. They said, for once and for all, we're going to wipe out the scourge of smallpox. They chose Africa and Brazil, launched a massive vaccination campaign. Immediately, AIDS began to appear. Thousands and thousands of people began dying of the strange new virus, which the World Health Organization then said has come from the bite of a green monkey. They forgot to tell you the green monkey has been there for centuries, and he's been biting people, if he ever did, for centuries, but no disease of that nature had ever occurred. The World Health Organization deliberately took this virus, which was crafted from a series of animal viruses, including Medievirus sheep, which destroys the brain, which is why you find AIDS patients get dementia probably first before any of the other AIDS-related complex diseases appear. And they began vaccinating innocent people on a massive scale, and they began dying like flies. Why Africa and why Brazil? Because those two countries have the biggest black population in the world. And I want to tell the black people of the United States of America, do not trust the Democrat Party. Do not trust government. Do not believe that government is your friend. To you, to them you are dispensable, the same way as we are. Millions of people died. I went through Uganda on an inspection tour, and I saw whole areas decimated where previously there had been small towns and villages. There was not a living soul in sight. And that is going on today. The AIDS epidemic is completely out of hand. It swept the world. It's been swept under the carpet in the United States of America. We were told that this is a disease which is passed by homosexuals. True enough, but that's not the primary cause of it. This is a crafted virus that was spread throughout the world to decimate the population. Coming behind them, and we reported this about 2 years ago in our World Interview and News magazine, is the Vibro 19 cholera virus, a deadly killer. You get this cholera in the morning, it is not immediately treated with massive doses of expensive antibiotics, you'll be dead in a day and a half. This epidemic swept India, carrying away millions of people. I don't know if you've heard of it in the press, I doubt it. Behind that is a deadly strain of malaria, and some of our forces in Somalia contracted this disease. A strain of malaria which acts almost like the HIV virus. It attacks the human immune system. And behind that, the Black Plague. Now, you've had some experience with Black Plague recently. Experiments were conducted in this area and in California with the Black Plague, distributing them, these plague viruses, to definitive areas by means of enfolded scalar waves using extremely low-frequency radiation, which was a warfare technique developed in 1934 by the great Soviet virologist V.A. Gerdtke. This is not Buck Rogers stuff, ladies and gentlemen. This is today's deadly truth. Some of the Indian reservations were targeted, and all of a sudden they began dying of black plague. And then we were told, well, the harvest mouse droppings are responsible. Well, the harvest mouse has been doing his droppings for centuries, but none of them got the black plague before that. But what happened immediately following the so-called population control meeting in Cairo, there was a sudden and violent outbreak of black plague in India. And it is still going on, and it is not under control. This is all part of the Global 2000 mass genocide plan. I know something about the black plague because in my research in the British Museum, I discovered that the black Venetian nobility had never, none of their families or members had ever got the black plague. Yet the black plague, as you know, swept through Europe and killed half of the population of Europe. But none of their families ever got it. So I began seeking for the answers, and I found them in the Cairo Museum. So people said, well, how come, if these things are true, how are they going to protect themselves? They being the Committee of 300, their servants and their families, they have the means of protecting themselves by certain types of herbal compounds mixed with sugar. And they also have, of course, the protection of extremely low-frequency radiation, where using the technology developed by the great virologist Gerdtke, who proved that every living thing on this earth has a vibratory cycle, He was able to measure the vibratory cycle of various deadly viruses, and by vibrating them, double their cycle, he would kill them instantly. So that's one of the defensive weapons that these people have got that will kill the plague if they ever get it. The same technique, of course, will kill cancer cells. But the medical profession, run by the Rockefeller family and all the pharmaceutical companies, do not want you to know this, because when you go into the doctor, he's going to write you a prescription for a chemical drug. There's no chemical drug benefit out of extremely low frequency radiation vibration. No profit to these people. So that's the Global 2000. Decimate the world's population, and particularly hit hard the United States middle class. How are they financing all of this stuff? They're financing it through the Fondi, who I mentioned to you earlier, the Venetian Black Nobility. Now, why are they called the Black Nobility? They're called that because of the vileness and the evilness of their deeds. These families date back to the 11th century, the Locatis, the Recanatis. They were called, and the Guelphs, by the way, I'll come to them, they're particularly interesting. They were called that because of the evilness of their deeds. They make Lucrezia Borgia look like a Sunday school teacher. They have so much money, which is the outcome of the drug trade, the years of investing, the years of gaining control of every mining, mineral, gold, oil, natural resource of the world, that they can afford to finance these things. So the Black Nobility are the ancient aristocrats of Venice and Genoa, and they call that because of the nature of their deeds. The Black Guelph was one of the worst of them. Now, interesting enough, the Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth II, is a Guelph. She's not a Windsor. This is a title that was evolved in 1935 by her father to put researchers off the track. I like to include myself in that category, although I wasn't doing it then. I was much too young to be doing it, but he didn't like that certain people were getting hot on the track of who this royal family actually was, and so this was put out as they are the House of Windsor. They are not. They are the House of Guelph, and it's important for us to know that, because every time there's a financial crisis, it follows a meeting of the Black Guelph upon the Royal Britannia yacht of the Queen of England, which anchors off the coast of Venice. And all the world bankers meet over there and say, now this is what we're going to do to country X. This is how we're going to control this worldwide situation. And then they go off and give their orders to everybody. So that is the way it is done. I told you earlier that they control the United States. Even in the days of President Lincoln, they had him assassinated on the orders of Disraeli. And they then, of course, in later years, were able to elect one of the worst socialists who've ever had the misfortune to suffer under, Woodrow Wilson. Wilson was elected by a ploy. Of course, they got Teddy Roosevelt and the Bull Moose Party running as a supposedly third candidate to siphon votes off so that Wilson could be elected as a socialist president. Now, our eyes have been fixed on Moscow. We've been led down the garden path, ladies and gentlemen. All of the time we've been looking at Moscow, and we've been told what dealings they are in Moscow. Rightly so. But all the time this was going on, the Trojan horse of socialism in Washington, D.C. has been stealing our country away from us. And in my book, Socialism, the Road to Slavery, I give you a full and factual description of exactly how this was done. In 1898, the Fabian Society, a socialist organization, sent Ramsay MacDonald, Prime Minister of England, to the United States to spy out the land. He came back and he said, there are two things in the way. You have a very strong middle class, and you have the Constitution of the United States, both of which have got to be destroyed before we can socialize America. The first step they took was getting a socialist president in office in the form of Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was controlled out of England by Sir William Wiseman, head of the North American desk of MI6. Now, in case you don't know MI6, it is the most powerful and the oldest of all intelligence agencies in the world. They taught the CIA. They taught the Vatican intelligence. They taught the French intelligence. They taught the Mossad. They taught the Cheka. Captain Hill of MI6 went out and set up the Mossad. And Captain Hill went to Russia and helped the Bolsheviks set up their single-cell apparatus. Sir William Wiseman was the controller of Wilson through Colonel House. Now, who was Colonel House? He was an unknown person who emerged out of Texas. His father served the Rothschild during the Civil War, and he emerged out of the war as the only person in Texas who'd made any money. And House was sent to Washington in order to control the first socialist president, and he took his orders from Wiseman. And House lived about a few blocks away from Wilson, and above him, Wiseman had an apartment. And that type of control is not gone. It is still here to this very day, right now, as I speak to you. Other questions? Give us some examples of what you're talking. How do we know that what you're saying is true? I'll refer you to the great soldier son of the United States of America, General Douglas MacArthur, a great patriot, a great warrior, a great Christian. When Douglas MacArthur was in Korea, he and General Stratemeyer of the Air Force devised a plan that would have put China out of action for the next 50 years. He submitted this plan to Washington. An arch socialist, one of the most vilest creatures who ever walked this earth, by the name of Dean Rusk, immediately summoned the President of the United States to a meeting in Blair House. And he said, "Mr. President, we have seen the plan submitted by General Douglas MacArthur, and there's no way in the world that you can allow him to implement this plan." And Truman said, "Why not?" He said, "You know very well that anything that relates to China has to be cleared by the Royal Institute for International Affairs first." And he said, "They don't want you to do this." And MacArthur was not allowed to carry out his plan. And 50,000 sons, beautiful Americans, were slaughtered on the battlefields of Korea needlessly because of orders from the Royal Institute for International Affairs. And that same institute is controlling President William Jefferson to this day. MacArthur was eventually bowler-hatted on the orders of the British government. I mentioned earlier the death of John F. Kennedy. Given the methods that are well known in intelligence circles of how to get rid of bothersome people, it would have been a very simple matter to make it look as though Kennedy had died of a heart attack or some other natural cause. Instead of that, in order to warn every president that would follow in his wake, every powerful person in this country in the know, "You do not kick over the traces. You obey us, or you will see what will happen to you." Kennedy was publicly and brutally executed in a plan carried out by British MI6 under the control of Sir William Stevenson and his lieutenant, a Canadian citizen by the name of Major Louis Mortimer Bloomfield. Now, you won't get that in any of the accounts of the Kennedy assassination. You'll find it in my book, The Committee of 300. You'll also find it in my monographs about the Kennedy assassination. Who are these people? Sir William Stevenson ran American intelligence throughout the Second World War out of the RCA building in New York. His second in command, a Canadian citizen, Major Louis Mortimer Bloomfield, ran Division 5 of the FBI counterintelligence. You want examples of how Britain controls this country? I have given you them. I've also told you that every Secretary of State since 1919 is selected by the Royal Institute for International Affairs on the orders of the Committee of 300. Why is this? We go to these conventions and there's all the hoopla in the world. The balloons are flying, the straw voters are in the air. Bush has been elected conservative president. Reagan has been elected. What happens in reality? The Secretary of State is charged with carrying out the policies, subverts each and every one of them. You show me a Secretary of State that has acted in the best interest of the United States of America since 1919, and I will give you the only money that I've got in the bank, which is about $1,500. You're welcome, sir, because I know that you will not be able to do that. Every Secretary of State has subverted and acted in a treasonable manner towards the people of this great country. And when they haven't done it directly,
They've done it through surrogates like Lachlan Curry, who ordered the military to jettison a shipment of arms destined for the great Chinese leader, Chiang Kai-shek, to jettison overboard his arms in the Indian Ocean.
And that's exactly what they did. We think that we elect our presidents. Ladies and gentlemen, we do not elect our presidents. They are selected for us long before we've even heard of them. And I've given you two examples this morning of how this is done. The 300 office at Aspen keeps a tight control over every political event that takes place in this country. And it was this office, through Margaret Thatcher, that ordered President Bush to violate the Constitution of the United States of America and to violate his own personal oath to uphold the laws of the United States by sending our troops to the Gulf War against Iraq, a nation that had never done us any harm. And we did it by the dirtiest of dirtiest tricks. We got the daughter of one of the Al-Shabaab clan, the over 400 of these people, and these are the most degenerate, disgusting people that you've ever come across. The ruler has 140 wives. He doesn't have them all at the same time. When he gets tired of one, he says, I divorced thee three times, and she's gone. And the Iraqi troops came in there, and they turned it over to the Red Cross in Geneva, 140 marriage certificates. This is the man that your sons and your daughters are propping up today in Kuwait in a most illegal manner, in violation of the Constitution of the United States of America. And Bush did a Texas two-step around the Constitution. He did not get the mandatory declaration of war. I'm not a lawyer, but I've studied the annals of Congress, the congressional votes, and the congressional records for 25 years. And in those pages will be found more wisdom, more in-depth information about the Constitution than you'll ever get from any law school. Anyway, most of the law schools have professors far to the left of Marx, and they don't know anything much about the Constitution. I talked to a few people, one lawyer in Congress. I said, what do you know about the Constitution? Well, I got one semester of law when I was at law school. And in that was something about the Constitution. Our Constitution is not even taught in the United States school system. Isn't that an utter shame and a resounding disgrace? Bush said the troops. Bush did not get a constitutional declaration of war. This is a very difficult area of the Constitution. It's probably one of the most complex areas of the Constitution. It's a five-step process that involves both houses making separate declarations, then joint declarations, then the army has to be informed, and then the public has to be informed, and then we have to be told whether it's a private war or a public war, i.e. whether all the armed forces are going to be employed or only one branch. In so-called police actions, the president has 45 days to use only one branch of the service. Bush violated his oath of office by going to the United Nations, to which we do not belong, and giving them to give him a so-called color so he could send our troops to the Gulf. Our troops to this day are in the Gulf illegally, in violation of the Constitution of America, and we're still paying for it. The story that the Gulf states put up all the money, you go and ask the General Accounting Office, as I did, how much money did they pay? We are still paying for the Gulf War. And now we've got another huge bill to meet, billions of dollars, for Clinton's fantasies. To go out there and support this disgusting Al-Shabaab clan. I don't even know the story of Kuwait. It's really a horrendous one. I don't want to get into that too much, but that land was stolen from the Iraqi people by the British imperialists. They came in and drew a line through the sand right through the middle of the moat. Important oil fields that just been discovered, the Rumelia oil fields, that henceforth this is going to be called Kuwait. And they brought up these chain sheikhs from Bahrain and put them in as the rulers. And since then they've been stealing the oil off Iran, and the proceeds go to the British banks in the city of London for the Committee of 300. They're just doing the same thing now in South Africa with the gold. That's part of their tactics to gain control of all natural resources through the world. I also touched briefly on Giovanni Agnelli and Mrs. Clinton and how she had left her husband, and Pamela Harriman. Pamela Harriman, for her duties in getting Clinton elected, was given a plum job as ambassador for the United States to France
And this is what happens to the traitors. Patriots are punished and traitors are rewarded. Dennis D. Consini, who voted for the giveaway of our property in Panama and who voted for the crime bill and every other obscenity that's passed by the federal government in violation.